Hey, thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Matthew Mitchell, and I have alcoholism. And it's a privilege to be on your meeting. I'm starting my timer, so fear not. I wanted to give a special shout-out to Pine Recovery. Hello, everybody at Pine Recovery. I was looking at you guys thinking I'd like to take an approach to the meeting tonight since I have 35 minutes to tell you what's happened to me in the last 28 years. 28 years ago today is my sobriety date. I got sober on May 16th of 1993. And coincidentally, or by the grace of God, my daughter was born to me on May 16th, 1993. And it was not a situation where, oh my God, I'm having a child, I should sober up. It was, I didn't want to have the child. I didn't want to have anything to do with her mom, and I didn't want to sober up. In fact, my mother used to say, Phoebe was early and you were late getting sober. But I did want to try to take a different approach and say that, you know, it's May 16th, and 28 years ago on May 16th, I was about to be whisked off to a rehab. But on May 9th of 1993, I worked the first step. And the first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I was living in an apartment in Redondo Beach right next to the ocean, and I hadn't paid the rent on it, and I hadn't hardly left it except to walk next door to the liquor store for several months. And it was Mother's Day on May 9th, 1993, and my brother came to pick me up to take me to Mother's Day, and I was drunk, and I ruined my mom's Mother's Day. And it was particularly upsetting because I was her youngest boy, and no one had seen me for a while, and I was very close to my mother, but also it was because she was dying of cancer, and the consensus was this would be your last Mother's Day. But I'd been awake for a couple of days, and I'd been drinking really hard, and I just went and ruined my mother's Mother's Day. And, you know, part of the way I behaved back then is I just had so much fear because I couldn't remember who I lied to and what I said. And I had this girl that crossed town. It was 18 years old, and I was 31 years old, and she was pregnant with my child. And I honestly didn't know who knew about it, because I lied all the time. I lost a job that I felt was beneath me. I don't know if any other alcoholics have ever lost jobs that were beneath them, but I remember thinking it was the lamest job I ever had, and then they fired me. I was so offended. But she was a waitress at a restaurant that I managed for a very short amount of time. And so what happened was I destroyed Mother's Day, my brother drove me home, and we got in an argument. And when he went back to his apartment, I called him to continue the argument. And he said, after I yelled at him for a while, he just said real quietly into the phone, he said, "Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism." And I don't know why I said this, but I reflexively said to him, "Of course I do." And for those of you in Pine Recovery Center, I worked the first step right in that second, because I finally admitted out loud that I had alcoholism, that I couldn't stop drinking. And I had tried every day for weeks and months before that. I mean, I didn't plan on having a baby this way. I was married to people that I was the child of a couple that was married for 50 years to each other when they passed away. I had two brothers and a sister that loved and adored me. I had a college education and talent for music, and I had just thrown it all away. And I was living in this squalor, not paying the rent and listening to people knock on the door and not answering the door, and being really abusive to this girl. And in fact, when she was 8.5 months pregnant early in May of 1993, I actually threw her down a flight of stairs. And she was, you know, 8.5 months pregnant with my child. And I didn't want to hurt her. And I certainly didn't want to hurt that baby. I just wanted her to get out of my doorway because she was telling me I shouldn't drink that day, because we needed to go to the doctor to see the doctor, and I just behaved like that. And when my brother said, "I think you have a problem with alcoholism," I surrendered in a little, tiny, little bit of a way. I said, "Of course I do." And my brother was a very strong member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was 7 years older than me, and he said, "Hold on." No, he said, "Don't go anywhere." And he jumped in his car, and he drove as fast as he could to get to my house. And if you're new in recovery, or even if you're not new in recovery, my brother recognized the most valuable, precious thing in recovery. He recognized a window of willingness. I had admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and it was clear my life was unmanageable. And sometimes that window can be very short. Sometimes you can watch it close in your own heart, and as you work the program and things go better for you, and you're unwilling to go to that one meeting because that one person might be there. You're unwilling to answer the phone whenever they call because now it's inconvenient and the movie's on. But at that time, I just had that raw willingness for a minute to say I'm an alcoholic. And my brother raced to my house. And he came in the door, and he scared me a little because I thought he was going to hit me. I thought he was going to beat me up, and I'd never drink again. And I sort of wished he would. You know, I mean, I'd ruined Mother's Day. He didn't know about what I'd been doing and how bad I'd become. But, you know, I was afraid of him, but I kind of wished somebody would just punch me in the face. You know, I had so much self-loathing. But my brother was a good member of AA, and he didn't. He took me to the beach, and he 12-stepped me expertly. And he convinced me that just by his being and his example, that I wanted what he had. And I was so scared and so out of plans. And I didn't know it, but at that time, I weighed 108 pounds. You know, I was wanted by the police. I was wanted by people that scared me worse than the police. I owed everybody money. I'd lost all my instruments to stupid deals I made just to get loaded. And I was a pathetic mess. And he just laid out what he felt like before he got sober. And he was sitting there clear-eyed and telling the truth. And I said, I wanted what he had, you know. And I said, I hopefully you people in Pine Recovery will laugh at this, but my brother said, I said, okay, I'll go to AA. And he looked at me and goes, oh yeah, man, you're not going to AA. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, you're going to a hospital. And I said, well, how long do I have to be in the hospital? And he said, I don't know, like 30 days. And I said, yeah, I can't do that. I'm busy. I haven't left my apartment in 6 months. I haven't paid a bill in 3 or 4 months. Everything's getting shut off. I'm getting evicted, but I'm too busy with my busy schedule to go someplace for 30 days. And just to pause, when I think about that, the insanity, I'm dying. I weigh 108 pounds. My body isn't working right. My digestive system's all screwed up. I'm not sleeping much at all. I'm drinking straight gin because nothing works anymore. And I feel crappy all the time. I'm wanted by everybody. I'm in debt. But I'm too busy to take 30 days out of this life I built to go to the hospital. It still, to me, is astounding to me. But I meant it. And I know you can relate. And you know what? It really was just fear. So that was May 9th when I worked the first step. The reason my sobriety date is May 16th is it took a while to figure out how to get me into a hospital. And my brother called me on May 15th. And he said, we're going to come tomorrow to take you to the hospital. And I was filled with terror by that. And I went and got as much as I could to drink. And I drank all night. I passed out and woke up, passed out and woke up. And then the phone rang. And I thought it was my brother, so I answered the phone, and it was a woman who told me my daughter was born a few hours before that. I'm surprised I'm being emotional today, but I've been on the phone with Phoebe quite a bit, and it's her birthday too. And they said, your daughter was born, can you come to the hospital? Now, I had been drinking all night. I have these OR scrubs and this T-shirt with a hole in it, and flip-flops on. I fell down on a big gulp when I passed out. It was stuck all over my back, all this. And I ran out the door to go to the hospital, and I drove directly to the wrong hospital. I always think this is funny because I've read the big book with lots and lots of people, and it says in the big book, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. And I drove to the hospital where I was born because that's the hospital where I knew babies were. So I drove there and they weren't there, you know, because that's where I came from. So I decided to kill myself. And I look back on that time when I think about that, and it wasn't because I was so depressed. It was partly that. I walked out to my car and thinking, you're such a loser. You can't even show up to see your child who was born, and you weren't even there. That was in my head. But honestly, if I really scrutinize how I was feeling, I was just so afraid. I didn't want to be a father. I didn't want to meet this child. I didn't want to go to rehab. I need medicine to be with you. And I don't want it. Go without it. So I decided to kill myself, And I put my head on the steering wheel and I turned the car on, trying to get the courage to pull the trigger. I had a gun at my house I used to put in my mouth when I'd get particularly dramatic and self-obsessed. And I put my head on the steering wheel and turned the car, the engine, and it jerked. The car backfired. And the name of the hospital came into my brain. And I hope that you stay sober long enough at Pine Recovery to realize that that is by definition the grace of God. I meditate and pray every day. I meditate for extended amounts of time, and I know that I don't control my thinking. I know that I don't decide what thought I'm going to have next. And that thought was not the thought I was grappling for. The thought I was grappling for was, I hope I have enough courage to kill myself. And this hospital name popped into my head. That is the grace of a power greater than myself. The actual electric synapses that happened were completely beyond my control. A series of events, a series of coincidences, thousands of things have to happen for every second to unfold. And that's how that second unfolded. And if it didn't, this wouldn't be my sobriety date. And I drove to the hospital and I ran up to see my baby. And I wasn't prepared, and I went in, and Anna was there, and she jumped out of bed, and she looked terrible. She just had a baby, and I remembered when I saw her that the last time I saw her, I'd almost killed her, and I felt humiliated. And then she came towards me, and she reached into this plexiglass box, and I'm afraid of what's happening. I'm afraid she's going to hug me. I realize I smell, and I'm a disgusting person, and she pulls out this little bundle named Phoebe Rose and hands her to me, and I'd love to tell you I fell in love with Phoebe. I'd love to tell you I felt that feeling that dads feel, like the world changed. But I didn't. I felt repulsed by her because she was so beautiful. And Anna had this purity about her. She'd just given birth to her first child. And I felt so disgusting and ugly and repulsive. And that is the definition of the bondage of self. I couldn't see the beauty that was right in front of me because all I could think of was, how did it reflect on me? And it made me feel like I was just a creep who crawled out from under a rock. And I knew I'd had the courage then. I knew I could go pull the trigger. And I handed my baby back to Anna, her baby, our baby. And I said, you know, that's funny. In the fourth step, I wrote, Anna got pregnant. And my sponsor said, I think you had a part in that. So I had to own my part in that. And anyway, I decided to go home and shoot myself. I was racing home in this crappy AMC car I had. And I ran up the steps, and my brother's standing there with a duffel bag. And he said, I packed your stuff. Get in the car. It's grace. It's just grace. I didn't get a go back in my apartment. Last time I saw that gun, I threw it away. You know, and that was when I was sober about 40 days. And so I got in the car, and I didn't want to go. I felt so afraid. My brother actually took me to my parents, and my parents took me to rehab. It was so humiliating. And I went in there, and 30 days later, I came out. All I remember from that rehab is I gained 47 pounds. Now, I've only worked the first step. I described it to you. And in rehab, they did all sorts of stuff. I'm sure that they get you to the fifth step, but they called a priest to hear my fifth step because they heard I was Catholic. It terrified me. I didn't want a priest to come in. It was terrible. I didn't tell that guy the truth. And they sent me back home, and I walked into my apartment, and there was a party going on. My brother had pushed me out of his car and said, go to a meeting. I didn't want to go to a meeting. I wanted to go see my child. I wanted to go see my mother who was dying of cancer. I wanted to clean my apartment and get a job, but I lie. I lie all the time back then. And my brother said, go to a meeting. And I said, yeah, of course, that's what I'm going to do. And I wasn't. And I went in and there was a party. I lived there by myself. And there were people blaring my stereo and drinking and smoking pot and snorting cocaine. And somebody handed me a beer. And I turned around and put that beer on my porch and I ran away from my own apartment. And if you're at Pine Recovery, I want to tell you, I didn't run away because I had a connection with a higher power. I did not have a foundation in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a momentary thought, and my thought was, Matthew, you have nothing. You have no self-respect. You have no prospects. You have very few people who care at all about you. You have no material things. But you got 30 days, man. And it's all that Matthew Mitchell could say belonged to him, if you can understand that. It was the only thing I had that you couldn't take, that I didn't owe you. It was mine. And for some reason, that came into my head, and I ran out the door, and I ran to a payphone, and I called AA, and I went to an AA meeting. I inadvertently, by accident, told my brother the truth, and I went to a meeting. And at that meeting, I didn't hear anything. I heard the speaker say, wah, 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 wah. The first speaker I remember hearing was 3 days later, and it was June G. And I spent the morning walking on the beach with June this morning at 7 a.m. But I didn't hear anything, and I tried to leave that meeting, and a guy intercepted me when I was walking out the door at the end, and he offered to take me home, and I said, I can't go home. And he knew where my parents lived, so he took me to my parents' house. I don't want to go to my parents' house. I'm 31 years old. I used to be a rock and roll musician. A year before that, I was playing at CBGB's in New York City. And now I'm getting dropped off at my parents' house in Torrance, California. It was humiliating. And again, I was afraid. I was so afraid because in there was good people. In there were people who did things that had consequences that made their lives better. In there were people that risked loving people, even though people returned love in a clumsy way and they saw it as a good deal. And they gave and didn't take. I don't even know what planet those people are from. And they're my parents. And they wanted me to go in there. And I'm this guy fresh out of rehab with a 30-day-old baby. I can't go in there. It's going to humiliate them. It's going to humiliate me. And I got news for you. My perception has very little to do with reality. And I bet $1 million yours does too. It's the nature of perception. We can't know. And I walked up and knocked on the door, and these two people answered the door who loved me more than anything on earth. And it came out of their eyes. And I was in exactly the right place. And I didn't know it. And I went inside, and I want to say something early on, if I have time. You know, we say things in AA like it's perfect. It'll be perfect. Life is perfect. I got to translate that. Perfect does not mean comfortable. If perfect meant comfortable, I wouldn't be here. I get a little discomfort that pushes me forward. I get into a situation and realize I'm holding back or I'm not telling the truth and I'm a little uncomfortable. And then I tell the truth and it was perfect just before I told the truth and it was perfect right after I told the truth. And when I tell the truth because I'm afraid to tell it, it's not comfortable sometimes what happens right after that, but it's perfect. And I went into my parents' house and I hated it and there was nothing wrong with them. But I woke up early in the morning and I had a meeting directly from the meeting before. And I go to my dad, hey, can I go to there's a meeting. Can I take the car? And he goes, don't even ask. If you're going to a meeting, take the car. So I drove to this 7 a.m. meeting and I hated it. It was worse than my parents' house. You guys are all bright eyed and bushy tailed and your coffee sucks and nobody knows me and everybody's hugging each other. And I feel like I'm green and everyone else is flesh tone. You know, it was so self-conscious. So I'd race home. As soon as I got out of the meeting where I didn't like it, I'd go home to my parents. And slowly over time, something happened. And it's the second step describes it. It says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And what that looked like to me was I started waking up a little early so I could help my dad make breakfast for my dying mother because I liked their company. They were loving and kind and interesting. And all I saw the first few months was they're looking at me. I'm a failure. They're old. My mother's dying. I can't look at that. But after a while, I wanted to participate in it. And then I'd go to a meeting and there'd be, you know, Sharon's going to come. And Sharon always talks about her sex life inappropriately. I love Sharon. I can't wait to see her at the meeting. And, you know, I'd go and then, oh, Bill's going to be there. And Bill makes sweeping, you know, generalization opinions. And everybody's so controversial. And I just started liking the meetings and liking being at home. I came to believe. It doesn't say somebody read We Agnostics until we yelled uncle. It says we came to believe. And that's what happened to me. and I didn't even know it. And I'm going to this guy's apartment, and we're reading the book, and when we get to a step, we work it. And I got to tell everybody in Pine Recovery in Visalia, California, I thought my sponsor was an idiot the first year of recovery. I'd go to his house and I'd go, oh my God, you know, I've got this new baby and her mom doesn't want me to see her now, and I owe all this taxes and I'm living with my parents. And he'd go, yeah, I think we're on chapter 5. And I'd be like, dude, can you not hear me? And he'd go, I think we're on chapter 5, right? And we'd start reading chapter 5, and because I thought I had issues and I thought this guy was supposed to help me with my issues. I didn't understand the steps. They looked like they were in Chinese. And then after a while of doing them, I realized I didn't have issues. I had circumstances. The steps addressed my issues. And one of my issues, I thought I was the center of the world, and I thought that I had to make things work and make things happen. I'd had some success. I'd gotten into a band and had success. I graduated from college at the top of my class. Every place I went to work until I kept getting fired, before that, I'd become the manager. And I didn't know I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. And I didn't know that that didn't mean when I stopped drinking, I'd be able to manage my life. It doesn't mean that. In all the years I've been here, you know, the third step is I turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That means no one's asking me to interview for the management position of my life. I'm not even asked to submit a resume. I'm asked to participate in my life. I'm not asked. I break into the manager's office at night and mess with the computer and knock shit over. And then the next day they go, thank you very much. We'll take it from here. You're not a manager. You're a participator. And welcome. We got a big show for you. And I did a fourth and a fifth step. And you know what? There's a line by Anthony DeMello that I cherish, and it reminds me of the fifth step. It says, loneliness is not dispelled through contact with other people. Now, I was very lonely when I came to AA. And I was lonely at CBGB's in the middle of a crowd. And I was lonely sitting on my couch in the middle of the night. But it says, loneliness is not dispelled through contact with other people. Loneliness is dispelled through contact with the truth. And when I did a fifth step, I got in contact with the truth. And somebody knew all my stuff, and I understood that I was pretty much the root of all my problems. And my loneliness went away. Because the distance between who I wanted you to believe I was and who I really was disappeared. I was now actually the person that I was representing every day. It wasn't a great... Nobody was, you know, wanting my life, but at least I was inhabiting my life. I was who I was, and I did a fifth step. And then 6 and 7, I want to talk about that for a minute. The sixth step says, I will read it. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And the seventh step says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. It later says in the literature, this is a lifetime job. But I want to say, it is a lifetime job that pays very handsomely. And I'm going to explain how it's worked for me. And when I was sober for a little while, I married a beautiful, stunning woman. And we had a great wedding. And when we had children, Ann and Phoebe came to the hospital. And it was amazing, right? And after a few years, my beautiful wife, when we were married for 5 years, had a massive stroke. And she became brain damaged and paralyzed permanently on her left side. And we soldiered on, right? Well, I've been married to that girl for 25 years in this sobriety. And I love my wife. I really do. But I'm also a really good arguer. I'm really good at it. If you do something to me that slights me, I make a case instantaneously in my head. I line up my evidence. It is an airtight case. I am going to bulldoze you over with how I'm going to win this argument. And I'll go downstairs and talk to my wife about how she is not loving me appropriately or she does not appreciate me. And I will give her examples. And I will watch my brain-damaged wife retreat into the back of her eyes. And I will win the argument. And I'll feel like shit. And that's how over time you realize I have a character defect. I'm arrogant. And I don't like the results my character defect has in my life. And I wish God would remove it. And I don't do that to my wife anymore. And I can honestly tell you that, partly because I've been telling this story for a while and I can't. I'm now so aware that I'm not going to set myself up to do that to her because I hate winning an argument with her. She's not out to get me. We have discussions. Sometimes we disagree. But that's what the 6 and 7 step is like to me. It doesn't happen like, oh God, please remove lust. And then the next day I wake up and I look at women and they all look like the Virgin Mary to me. It's not like that at all. It's like I become aware consistently of the results of my misbehavior based on the mistaken idea that I am in charge. That's an old idea. It takes a long time to get out. And when I start to approach my life at work, with my children, at my marriage, that stuff starts to bubble up to the top, and I want God to remove my character defects. And the 6th step, it talks about how we try to hold on to them. I've been here 28 years, man. I'm like, take them. And the ones I'm not aware of, show me. And after you show me, take them. and it really is a lovely place to live. It is a lifetime job that pays big dividends. And then we get to 8 and 9. And 8 and 9 are terrifying when you're new. A lot of people come into AA and they look at step 1, they look at step 9, and they go, I can't do this. Right? I'm going to go make amends to the people I've harmed. My list was long. I have many, many amends stories, but I'll tell you one. I owed a guy $15,000. Now, to some of you, that's nothing. I was a musician. He worked at a restaurant and got fired from the restaurant. $15,000 I had not seen in one place in a long time. And I wasn't going to see it for a long time. I owed everybody money. But I owed this guy $15,000. And my sponsor said, just start paying him. Send him a letter. And I go, well, I don't have any money. He goes, well, how much do you have right now? I got $20. You send him $20. And I sent him $20, and then my sponsor would prod me at a meeting. Did you send Larry any more money? And I go, no. And he goes, send him more money. So I'd send him $20 more. I owed him $15,000. It was like I grew up in the 70s in the South Bay. We used to empty swimming pools to go skating. It was like that, walking out to an empty swimming pool with an eyedropper and holding it over the deep end and putting a drop in and going, someday I will swim, you know. I mean, the optimism I had to muster up just to send another $20 was ridiculous. And then I got a better job, you know, and I sent him $100. And sometimes I forgot and didn't send him any money. But I kept real good track in a notebook because when I'm stealing from you, I'm very vague about the amount. But when I'm paying you back, I'm very specific about how much I paid you back. I don't want to miss anything, man. And so, but I was sober a long time. I think about 7 years. And Larry called and he goes, stop sending me this money. And I said, why? And I went and got the notebook and he's talking. He said, well, you're a good son. You're a good husband. You're the guy I always knew you could be. You're great, man. I love you. I was best man at Larry's wedding. He said, stop sending me the money. You paid me back. And I looked at the bottom and I paid him $7,000. So I owed him $8,000 more. And I made the mistake of calling my sponsor. And I told my sponsor, I'm done. I'm done paying Larry. And he goes, really? Wow. And he goes, how much did you owe him? $18,000. How much did you pay him? $7,000. Well, then you're not done. And I go, no. He called, you know. And he said, look, man, if you want to stop doing what's working, that's cool. And he hung up. And I knew I had to pay Larry. And I did. I actually ended up writing him a check for $8,000 because my mother did die. She died in my arms. And then my father died. And I was with him every day when he died. And he left me some money. And I gave it. I told my wife. I go, I know we're struggling here, but I really need to pay him. And my wife, who's not in AA, said, we live a way I've never lived before. And it works real well. You go ahead and send him that money if that's what you think is best. And that's a brave woman because we had 2 little children then. And I sent that money, and Larry called me the next day, and he said, you're not going to believe it. My wife, Wendy, just told me she was pregnant last night. And I was laying awake trying to figure out how I could get enough money together to have a down payment to buy the house we're renting. And I have it now. I was short $8,000. And that's one great part of that story, that this guy got to buy a house with his own money that I paid back. But the other great part about that story is I have walked free. I go into any room. I don't care who's in there. I'll meet you right on. I want to meet you. I'm excited to meet you. I'm not afraid of who you might be. I'm not hiding. I pay my bills. I live in a beautiful home. And I have a feeling my life would not go as well as it's gone if I tried to hold on to other people's money out of fear that I wouldn't have enough. It wasn't my money in the first place. And all the money I've ever gotten and every reward I've ever gotten came to me through the grace of God. I don't try to boast as if I earned it. It just comes. And if you live in this spiritual way, these things happen all the time. So I started doing 10 and I started meditating. Through a series of events, I started this call with Jay, who's on the call. And we started meditating for 5 minutes together every morning and then 10 minutes. And now we do it for 22 minutes and almost everybody on this call is in that meditation group. There's a lot of us here in that meditation group. And I thank you for coming. And I can tell you, so much has come to me by just doing that every day, where I'm a father of four. You know, I don't react. I respond more. I'm more present for things. You know, my friend June, we were talking about the challenges of our children. Some of them have anxiety. One of my children has a mental issue right now, his mental health issue. And she said, you know, Matthew, we don't go down into the darkness after them. We stand firmly in the light so they can find it. And that is challenging. But I have meditation and I have prayer and I have a fellowship of it. And I know that that's the truth. I don't need to go into the drama. I need to be the sanity. And the number one contributor to my sanity in the last 28 years has been regular prayer and meditation. I'm down in about 4 minutes and I want to talk about the 12 step. And if you're in Pine Recovery, I'm singling you out on purpose. But I'm telling everybody this. My group told me right off the bat, you know, we go help people. We go to panels. My sponsor, Bill, says the most spiritual sentence in Alcoholics Anonymous is get in the car. And I've done it. I sponsor lots of guys. Today, 9 of them were here with my sponsor to celebrate my 28th birthday. And that's just part of it. I go to prisons. I go to jails. I actually 12-stepped a guy who robbed my house. After he robbed my house, he got sent to jail. And I was taking a panel to the jail. And I didn't know which one he was, but he was there. And I've done it all. I've done it. I keep inconveniencing myself for others because that's where the spiritual growth is. Perfect is not comfortable. But every time I go to these prisons, I say, hey, how many people in here have been to AA? And everybody raises their hand. And I say, how many people in here have gotten a sponsor? And about half of them raise their hands. And then I say, how many people in here have gotten a sponsor, worked the steps? And about 3 of them raised their hand. And these are room full of 80 guys. And they'll say, how many of you sponsored anyone? And nobody raises their hands. And I tell them, that's why I'm coming in to visit and going home to my wife. Because I realize that Alcoholics Anonymous is about giving. Somebody said to me the other day in a meeting, he said, the emptiness inside of me has never been filled by someone loving me enough. The emptiness inside of me has been filled by me doing something as an act of love to somebody that I don't know. And that's the truth. That's my truth. What Alcoholics Anonymous will do, it will treat your actual issue. And I think my biggest issue can be summed up in the third step prayer when it says, relieve me from the bondage of self. And there's no way out of that on your own. You don't know the map out of the maze of the bondage of self on your own. But these 12 simple spiritual exercises give you relief. I feel relief. I woke up this morning and went for a walk with my friend June G on the beach because that's how I wanted to spend the first part of my 28th birthday. I spent the next hour and a half on the phone with Phoebe Rose, who was born the day I got sober. She's a nurse, a psych nurse now in Portland, and we had a lovely talk. We both kept crying and telling how much we were proud of each other. And then I came home and my daughter Sophie came down and we baked a cake together. And then my boys came and my sponsor came and we sat out in the back and smoked cigars and we told the truth to each other. We had an intimate experience with 10 men just talking to each other about what really is happening. Now, if you're new here and you want to try to figure out how to do this all on your own, you don't need to do that. And there's no reason to do that. Do not deny yourself the lifelong experience of relief from the bondage of self. 35 minutes. Thanks for letting me share.
Wow. Thank you.